You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Pozze scendere, pozze, pozze vicine. Non spigudeci ancora, non spigudeci ancora. Pozze scendere, pozze, pozze vicine.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I think I'm Richard Moore again now. I feel it's long enough since I left Italy to revert to my birth name. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And guest presenter tonight for a run of our Giro podcasts, which might tip into the Vuelta as well, Ian Boswell.
Thanks for having me, Richard. Good to see you again, Lionel.
Not good to see me, Ian.
Well, it is good to see you. Both of you are sideways on my screen, so...
Probably look better like that, I think. How are you, Ian? You're in Vermont. Is the weather there as bad as it is in Italy at the moment?
Surprisingly, no. It's a beautiful sunny day. The leaves have all fallen. It's been a late autumn. We've had a couple cold, rainy days, and it's supposed to rain again tomorrow. But no, what an absolutely miserable day at the Giro. I'm happy to not be there right now.
Indeed. Well, we'll be talking mainly about the stage at the Giro today, Cesenatico to Cesenatico. We'll hear from James Knox, who survived the stage, and they kept the pink jersey in their team. Sort of growing calls for the Giro to not finish. People wondering if it's even going to be possible. And we haven't even started the third Grand Tour of the season yet. We should be joined tonight by Daniel Freeb as well, but, well, I don't want to steal your line, Ian, but you came up with a great line when Daniel briefly joined us on the call and explained why he wouldn't be able to make it tonight.
Yeah, he's having as many technical issues as Richard Freeman.
Indeed, yes. He's having technical issues. As far as we know, he's not demolished his laptop with a hammer or a screwdriver, but... he is having problems with his computer. So Daniel will be rejoining us tomorrow night, we promise you. We should explain for listeners, of course, Ian is a regular on Explore, our sometimes monthly series. It's resuming soon, isn't it, Lionel?
It is, yeah.
But also, and more notably even than that, he is former professional rider with Team Sky and Katusha Alpecin, retired at the end of last year. So what's it like watching? I mean, you've ridden the Giro before, Ian. What's it like sitting at home watching it?
I've been enjoying, watching a stage like today is much more enjoyable on the TV than it is to be racing. But it's been some exciting racing, you know, following such a dramatic tour a couple weeks ago only. It's really been kind of wild to see how open the racing is. I mean, today's stage was incredible. You know, you've seen some awful weather and the Giro, you know, when it is in May, we've seen snow and foul weather, but to see it in October and kind of a very wide open race has been something unique. And, you know, it's been a crazy year for so many riders, but I think we're all happy to see racing returning, and we'll see if we can make it to the end of the season and the third and final Grand Tour.
What's weird about it, I suppose in May, you have a sense, don't you, of you're racing towards summer. Even if the weather's bad, there's always the hope and the possibility that it's going to improve. Whereas when it's really bad and you're kind of racing into autumn/early winter, that must be quite tough psychologically, I think.
Well, there's on that note, there's been something I've been kind of thinking myself, and how much riders have almost an internal biological clock. You know, it's so many riders hit, you know, mid-October and, you know, biologically, just after year of racing in the World Tour, your body just seems to, like, even now, you know, I'm a year out of professional racing, you know, mid-October hits and I'm like, oh, I want to chill out, kick my feet up, you know, dig into some Ben and Jerry's, you know, drink a couple more beers. And it's just a natural path that you develop over so many years. And I wonder how many riders kind of feel that same way racing the Giro at this point in the season. And then riders, you know, who are preparing for the Vuelta, and normally they would be on holiday right now on a beach somewhere, kicking back, relaxing.
Look out for the 6-day specialists. They'll come into their own at the Vuelta, maybe.
Ilho Kaiser is going to win the Giro. He's going to suddenly...
I think Michael Morkov will win the Vuelta, won't he?
Yeah.
Shall we get on with the Tale of the Tapper, please, Lionel?
Indeed. Well, yes, stage 12, a long, cold and wet one, starting and finishing in Cesenatico, Marco Pantani's hometown, of course. It was up and down all day, and we had another stage win for Ineos Grenadiers, their third of the race, this time for Jonathan Narvaez. The 23-year-old is the third Ecuadorian to win a stage of the Giro after Richard Carapaz last year and Jonathan Caicedo earlier in this race. Narvaez was part of a 14-man break that shaped the day. They built a big lead going over the penultimate climb. Simon Clark of EF Pro Cycling was out in front, but Narvaez and Mark Padun, the Ukrainian rider with Bahrain McLaren, caught and passed them. Then on the final descent, Padun punctured and was consigned to a long, fruitless chase to try and get back on terms with Narvaez.
He Corrections did. Corner there, Lionel. He actually broke his wheel, apparently.
Is that right?
According to our friend and colleague, Orla Shinawi.
Okay. Good. Because I was looking, I was trying to find out exactly what happened. Common reports were a puncture and then the Giro's press release said mechanical, so I was a little bit unsure, but a broken wheel. Well, anyway, he had to stop and get service, and then he had this long fruitless chase. He did get within 10 seconds of Narvaez with about 11 kilometers to go, but couldn't quite close the gap. And then there was this great kind of cutting between Narvaez in front and Padun behind, and the difference in their pedaling styles was quite stark. Narvaez looked really fluid and smooth, and Padun was all over his bike as the effort of chasing really started to take its toll. So a stage win for Narvaez, who clearly likes this area of Italy, because in early September he won a stage of the Settimana Coppi e Bartoli in Riccione, just down the coast, on his way to overall victory there. Meanwhile, behind in the peloton, it was absolutely smashed to pieces, and only 22 riders were left in the GC group. That was primarily because of some hard riding by, among others, NTT, who were looking to set up Domenico Pozzovivo for an attack. There were a few little moves from the veteran Italian, but he couldn't make anything stick, and all the leading riders, bar one, finished together. The only one who wasn't in that GC group was 10th placed Herman Pernsteiner of Bahrain McLaren. He lost over 3 minutes and has slipped down to 14th place. So João Almeida, he again was very well supported by De Koenig Quickstep, and who will have his 10th day in the pink jersey tomorrow, which looks like it will be one for the sprinters again. But let's hope the weather improves. We should also mention, because we're going to talk about the impact of COVID-19 on the race, that this morning there was the news that 17 police motorbike riders had tested positive for COVID-19. Now, they've been working with the e-race, the e-Giro d'Italia, which is going round ahead of the Giro d'Italia itself. So not great news for the organisation, that following the withdrawal of Mitchelton Scott and Jumbo-Visma earlier in the week.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses.
Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWocker.
If you run a business, find out more at iWocker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
My name is James Turner. I am the IT manager at iWocker. So I'm passionate about everything to do with bicycles, been sort of following the industry, racing, and taking part in racing for as long as I can remember, and it's something that helps me keep very much sane and occupied in my downtime. Typically, there's a mix of indoor training, commuting, and group rides out with the club. At iWocker, I see myself as heading up the sort of the technical team, which is responsible for enabling people to get their work done. IT at iWocker is a definite sort of service-based IT department. We're in charge of making sure the tool set for people to do great work is in place.
Thanks very much to our title sponsor, iWocker. They are in the business of helping small businesses. And we heard from one of their employees there, James Turner, a very keen and pretty good cyclist, I understand. If you run a small business and you would like to find out what iWocker can do to support your business, go to iwoka.co.uk.
Yeah, we'll be hearing a bit more from James and some of his colleagues in some forthcoming episodes of our Giro coverage. They recently did a charity bike ride, and we'll hear about what they were raising money for, probably in a couple of days or so. Maybe start of next week, we'll run a little series on that.
Well, chaps, Ian and Lionel, really entertaining stage today, and not so enjoyable for the riders, but enjoyable to watch. You know, another tough day that was potentially a GC day, and certainly for the second type of stage like that, you know, the one that Sagan won a couple of days ago, the Tirreno Adriatico stage, and today we saw a big push from NTT, the African team, which they're discovered on the eve of the race that the NTT will not renew with them next year. We have an episode of Kilometre Zero coming up on that, actually, and I listened to your interview today with Doug Ryder, the team boss, Lionel. So a very uncertain future for that team, and these two tough stages, they've really ridden as though, you know, their lives depend on it. They're riding for Domenico Pozzovivo, and you know, they've been an underperforming team, there's no doubt about it. The results have not, they have been a very unlucky team as well. They've had lots of injuries and so on to their best riders. But they've really rallied behind Pozzovivo, 37 years old now, riding with this injury that he sustained when he was hit by a car at the end of last year and then fell off again at the Tour de France. He looks pretty uncomfortable on the bike, but he's riding as well as he's ever ridden. And, you know, he's not far off the pink jersey. He was unlucky a couple of days ago when he had a puncture, a bad moment, but then he's still one of the strongest in the group. And today again, they rode all day and really hard to try and set him up for something, and it didn't quite materialise, but the intention is there, and clearly Pozzovivo's form is there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really impressed seeing how aggressive both NTT and Pozzovivo have been racing, and I've also been kind of surprised just at how much, you know, but kind of risk he's been taking on some of these wet roads for a guy who, you know, was hit by a car and knocked off last year, crashed out of the Tour, and still, you know, really, like you said, racing to win has been pretty, I did not expect that from a rider of his age and having the crashes recently that he's experienced to be racing like that. And I, rumors from inside the peloton were that, you know, because of his injury to his elbow, I'm going to, he's kind of reminds me of like a bird who has an injured wing because it kind of cocks out to the side, but that, you know, he's not as stable in the peloton as he was in the past. He's just not able to handle his bike, but he's still, you know, we've seen the last 2 days in a row that he's, or not the last 2 days in a row, but today in the stage that Sagan won, that he's really taking on the race and willing to take risk to, you know, potentially go for his last Grand Tour overall, you know, victory.
What kind of bird would he be, Pozzovivo? Quite a small bird, a sparrow.
A little blue tit or something, I think.
Well, that's appropriate.
In their blue kit.
They are in blue. Yeah. But, you know, Pozzovivo's always been one of these riders, very consistent, always kind of there or thereabouts. We would almost say maybe in the past guilty of riding a la Zubeldia. That's maybe unfair because he's also been quite aggressive at times too, but never really seen him like this, I don't think. And it is almost as if, you know, he is just maybe riding in the bunch is so uncomfortable that he wants to get up the road on his own. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, today on the final climb, you know, he was left with no teammates and he was trying to attack over the top and put a lot of riders into, you know, a difficult place, which was, you know, crazy because a guy of his, you know, stature and kind of size, he's not going to be riding the front in a group of, you know, two riders to the finish line because there was still a fair chunk of change to go before the finish. But, you know, he's definitely taking this race on, and maybe he's a rider who thinks that the race may not make it to Milan.
Yeah, I mean, Pozzovivo is six times in the top 10 at the Giro, but never higher than fifth. His last stage win was in 2012 in the Giro. I mean, it is kind of, well, 37 now, and as you say, with the injuries from last year's crash, You know, it is kind of the last chance saloon for him, kind of now or never, I guess, to see whether he can get onto the podium in his home Grand Tour. And the GC, I mean, it's this fascinating battle, isn't it, between the veterans and the youngsters, really. But I do wonder that this image of Pozzovivo nursing his wing, do you think at the end of the day, Bjarne Riis...
There's a joke coming, isn't
there? Bjarne Riis cups him delicately in the palms of his hands and just strokes Pozzovivo on the head and says, you've got through today. Yeah, you know, flap as hard as you can tomorrow.
I imagine that Riis and Doug Ryder, for that matter, are absolutely loving Pozzovivo at the moment because he's giving them something that they've not had. You know, and they have signed good riders like Michael Valgren and people like that who unfortunately have not been able to deliver for whatever reason. Pozzovivo, the most, you know, when they signed Pozzovivo, I just thought it seemed a bit desperate. You know, they've tried with quite a lot of aging stars, Gasparotto, Kreuziger, guys like that, and it has looked a bit desperate at times, and I thought Pozzovivo was another desperate roll of the dice. But, you know, just to have somebody in that shape and with that confidence, the confidence to say to his team, drive it, you know, just drive it really hard, make it as hard as possible, that brings out something in the team that we've not seen before. And Ben O'Connor rode really well today, and I spoke to him at the start of the race, and he was a bit under the weather at the time, and just at that time, and just hoping to get through those few days, and really very disappointed at the time in his own form, because he's been very promising in the past, but he rode outstandingly well today. And just having that, I mean, what does that do, Ian, to I remember you kept an audio diary for us at the Tour de France a couple of years ago, and, you know, what came through in that was you had Ilner Zakarin there, and okay, Zakarin wasn't challenging for the podium, but having a focus to help him into the top 10 really seemed to bring an awful lot more out of you guys.
Yeah, I think that, you know, having a purpose in a race is key for anyone, and obviously every team enters Grand Tours with a specific goal, whether it's a sprinter or a GC rider, stages. But so many teams, you know, we saw it in the Tour, we see it here, where, you know, a rider crashes out, a rider gets sick, and all of a sudden teams are left with nothing to really chase. And I think, you know, Pozzovivo rising up and telling his team, hey, this is what we're riding for, and they're riding for a lot more than just, you know, pink, which, you know, obviously Pozzovivo would love, but, you know, that's just, they're very much a team searching for contracts, and not just Pozzovivo, but everyone within that team, the organization. There's got to be a lot of pressure on them. And it's probably due to Pozzovivo's, you know, experience that he knows that having a positive goal and not lingering on the fact that the team could come to an end at the end of the year is something really valuable and important for them.
Well, there was also the stage win battle today, and that was a big break that had a big lead. It was about 14 minutes at one point, I think, and NTT cut it in half. You know, they were going hard. Maybe the break wasn't going so hard all day, but hard enough for two of them, well, three of them to, well, more than that, sorry, quite a few of them survived. But Jonathan Narvaez was the winner in sort of slightly fortunate circumstance with Padun having that problem with his wheel. Who knows how it would have ended up. And it just, you know, I think if Padun had caught him, I think he'd have won. It was on a sort of knife edge. And Padun chased really hard. As you say, Lionel, close it to like 9-10 seconds. And then, you know, he just couldn't get that final, close that final distance, and Narvaez rode off to win. And both very promising young riders. Padun won a stage at the Tour of the Alps a couple of years ago, and I thought then that he was 22 then, and it was at a time when 22-year-olds didn't win races like that. It's very different now. But I don't know, do you know Padun at all, Ian? Did you come across him when you were riding?
I don't believe so. No, I did ride with Jonathan Narvaez a few times, rode the front with him when he was at Quick Step and I was at Katusha for our sprinters. But I've seen him, probably been in the same race, but I don't recall ever actually riding with him or, you know, being in a battle with him on a climb or something like that. But an impressive performance today. And yeah, and an unfortunate time to break a wheel, but he kept it up. And yeah, it's, you know, those roads around Cesenatico today are roads that, you know, a lot of riders who have raced in Kopi Bartoli, very similar stages, as you said, Lionel, on the roundup. Narvaez, he won there not too long ago. And so it's roads and a terrain that you could see today, you know, it's just up and down and left and right. And, you know, thankfully the roads weren't too slick. We didn't see a ton of crashes, but yeah, what a final.
And another graduate from the Axion Hagens Berman team as well. He rode with them in 2017 before, well, he'd ridden with the Klein Constantia team, which is got links to De Koenig Quickstep, hasn't it? And then he went to Axion Hagens Berman and then turned pro with Quickstep. And I'm not sure. I think he's got pretty fast finish, Rich. I think if Padun had got up to him, Narvaez probably would have had the better of him anyway. But it was immaterial anyway, because I mean he looks so good. I know Padun was rocking and rolling, wasn't he? But the contrast really was, it was kind of like the do's and don'ts of how to look good when riding solo, wasn't it? Narvaez looked very smooth, had obviously a big gear, but he was turning it very well, wasn't laboured at all. And thoroughly impressive victory. And
and their third stage win, Hagens Berman Action, as they're known now, and they have the rider in the pink jersey too. And we're speaking to another graduate of that team, not Lionel. He didn't come through that program.
I came through the Axion Burgers program, yeah.
Hagen Das team. But Ian, you did come through that team some time ago.
I did, yeah. I spent 2 years there, and it was a team that, you've seen it today. It's, very much still riders who came through that program are still friends, still family. I still stay in touch with riders who I raced with, and it's really become an organization that has left their stamp on the World Tour racing. I've seen so many riders come through that program and now at the front of these World Tour races.
We made a kilometer zero, Rich. I know we've mentioned this on social media about that team and some of the graduates from it during last year's Vuelta, didn't we? But Ian, what?
We did, but then, and I interviewed a few of the guys who were there, but I missed a few out who we had to then Photoshop into our slide afterwards, because there are so many of them.
Yeah, I was going to ask Ian, it's to have such a high strike rate of developing riders. How have they done that? There's probably a sort of 50-50 chance that if you do a season or two with that team, you'll get a pro contract and actually make it beyond the initial 2 years of the professional.
Yeah, well, I think, the team initially kind of started in a time when there wasn't a huge emphasis of development. There was the U.S. national team had a pretty strong, junior team and under 23 team, but riders just weren't getting the racing they needed in Europe outside of the national team. So the team was founded kind of around Taylor Finney. And I think pretty quickly they were able to recruit some of the best riders in the U.S. and abroad, kind of started off with a lot of Aussies, I think, and Kiwis, when Bewley was on the team and a few other guys. And from there, I think it really just became kind of noticed that riders from this team were going to the World Tour. So then it became pretty easy for them to recruit riders. When I was on the team, we had, George Bennett I was racing with, Jasper Stuyven, Jasper de Boos, so we had very quickly it became an international team where under 23 riders from around the world were messaging Axel to try to get on that team. So it became almost easy for Axel to get kind of the cream of the crop. And then from there, having that competitive and successful culture, it just raises the level of everyone.
And I guess having the surname Merckx makes it slightly easier to get into races as well, and give the riders the experience at the highest level that they can.
Have we even mentioned that Axel Merckx runs the team?
Well, there we are.
I don't know if we have. I don't think. But Axel Merckx runs the team.
I think his dad maybe won a few races. Eddie, not sure if you've heard of him, Rich.
Well, there was this very great line by Sam Abt when Axel Merckx retired that. Between it opened his piece looking back on Axel Merckx's career by saying, between them, Axel and Eddie Merckx have won 526 professional races. That's very unfair, because Axel Merckx was a pretty decent rider himself, who sort of lumbered with the Merckx name as a rider, but as a developer of talent, and it seems as a guy who's created this environment, this culture, he's done a brilliant job, and all the riders who've been through that program speak incredibly warmly about him.
And one of his biggest wins was a stage of the Giro in the year 2000 in Prato, not a million miles away from, inland. No, actually a million miles away. It's right over the other side, isn't it? Near Florence. It's in the same country.
When he also has, was he third in Athens Olympic road race? And I think when I spent some time at the Merckx's residence in Belgium between some races. And I think that's one thing that Axel hangs over his dad's head is that he has an Olympic medal and Eddie does not.
I mean, that's not a line that we get regularly from presenters in the Cycling Podcast, is it, that we hung out at Eddie Merckx's place?
I was actually, I have a little story about that. We were hanging out there and watching Brumps peel, and Eddie's wife made us some chocolate mousse from eggs that they had chickens out in the garden, and she asked us if we wanted some. I said, of course, yeah, if you're going to make us some chocolate mousse, I'll be more than happy to eat it. And subsequently, once we had finished, she had called Axel and reported on us that we had been eating chocolate mousse and kind of tattled on us after offering it to us.
It was a trap.
It was a trap.
Excellent. Oh dear, chocolate mousse. I've heard of a honey trap. That was a chocolate mousse trap. Well, listen, without further ado, should we hear from one of our audio diaries? We've got six riders keeping audio diaries at the Giro, and James Knox had a big day today helping his De Koenig Quickstep teammate João Almeida defend the pink jersey, looking increasingly kind of not comfortable but dislodgeable in a way. We've not hit the high mountains yet, but we'll maybe talk about this in the next part. Almeida is looking pretty secure in that pink jersey. He hasn't had any real serious attacks on it. So, and De Koenig Quickstep rode a fantastic race in defence of that jersey. They had bodies up there to help him. And, you know, at some point we'll maybe start to talk about Almeida as a serious challenger. But here's James Knox recovering from today's stage.
Hey, guys. Going to do my best to sound a little bit chirpy in this audio diary, but being brutally honest, I am an emotional, physical wreck here. I'm tuckered up in bed, finally starting to feel a little bit warmer, a little bit coming around after what was really one of the worst experiences of my life. Sounds dramatic, but it was truly awful. Like I said yesterday, Nova Collie, hard day out, 4,000 meters. A really, really hard day, actually. I know we didn't see big attacks and stuff, but NTT rode a really hard pace, and they set us all up for disaster because they went balls to the wall, all out on that Pugliano, the hard climb, with about 60 or 70k to go. I'm checking over my power files, and I did some very big numbers for me. And from there, it all went wrong because we all buried ourselves and then got frozen, absolutely frozen. It was pissing rain. I think it was about 7 degrees. And yeah, it was just piss wet through, freezing down these descents, shivering. I think I did 2-3 hours shivering, teeth chattering away, trying to get gels in me, riding the bike, but not actually riding the bike. It was not my bike. It was just swinging around from underneath me. Couldn't feel my legs, just sort of shuffling around. That being said, we did have four guys in the 20-man group, so we did do an outrageous ride. That's the one big positive. Yeah, I think this, you know, the front group, everyone was just dead, absolutely dead. There was no one could attack because no one could go hard. Well, no one could go any harder. It was just survival, basically. And then, yeah, tried to ride her into the finish. Got hot tea at 10k to go or something, 15k to go. That didn't do anything. Got to about 5k to go. Things started to get weird. The relentless shivering and stuff. And I just, yeah, started to feel like I couldn't ride the bike anymore. Couldn't really see. I started losing my vision. This sounds really dramatic, I know. But I think I just bunking, hypothermic, barreled up in one. Yeah, I just pulled out a line and just tried to get to the line because I was just couldn't do anything. Shivered in a hot shower for 20 minutes. Shivered drinking hot tea. Got driven straight to the hotel. And I've been in bed ever since. So yeah, what a lovely October Giro. Wow. Oh my God. Yeah, this is some audio diary. This, I'm really painting a nice picture, aren't I? But still got the pink jersey. We rode like troopers. So there's a lot of positives to be taken. But yeah, please, no more 8 degrees and pissing rain. Won't be pretty getting to Milan like this. Will not be pretty. I think we've got a PCR test later. Tell you what goes around quick and it'll get us into us all when we're all battered and bruised and broken men. Bit of coronavirus now, that's going to do some damage. So we'll see how that goes. Let's hope for some negative test results. Fingers crossed there. Yeah, that's about it. Glad everyone got round in one piece. A lot of broken men out there. Battlefield. What a horrible, horrible, horrible day. A day to be watching from the sofa, not to be out there riding anyway. Another day done. Thanks for coming.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. They do not make chocolate mousse, Science in Sport, at least not yet. Lionel was just saying that he is, well, stunned that he has never had any of Claudine Merckx's chocolate mousse. But maybe you have, Lionel, without even knowing
it. Well, I was saying, given the volume of chocolate mousse that I have eaten, it's the odds are that I probably have had some of Claudine Merckx's, but just without knowing it.
Well, if you'd like some proper sports nutrition products, go to scienceandsport.com and at the checkout, enter the discount code Ian.
SISCP25.
What was that, sorry?
SISCP25.
Oh, Ian, that's excellent. Fantastic. Didn't even help you with that. That's more impressive.
I actually still work, or I still use SIS, and I'm a SIS athlete. I actually have a code for 35% off, but I'm not sure if I'm supposed to share it on this podcast. And it's for
listeners, North American users. Don't get any ideas. It's not SISCP35.
It's not. It's not.
No, that's terrible bragging. I mean, your first appearance as a guest presenter and you come up with a brag like that.
I wonder how many people have tried entering SISCP95 just to see if they can get lucky. Anyway.
It doesn't work, folks. No. It doesn't work. 25% is incredibly generous.
It is.
You should fill your boots with Science of Sport products. Before the break there, we heard from James Knox. I think he just stopped shivering. But I think a very vivid description of what a tough day it was out there. And he sent me another message after he sent in that diary saying, I'll tell you what I'm not looking forward to, the Stelvio in a week. And as the weather deteriorates and we see riders in a, in a bad way. And I guess in the third week of a Grand Tour, everybody's tired and maybe battling illness in some cases, or their immune systems are under a lot of stress. That brings us on to COVID, and there have been cases. There's concern that the bubble at the Giro has not worked as well as it worked at the Tour de France. Jonathan Vauters of EF Pro Cycling, they've written an open letter requesting that the race be stopped on the second rest day, which is next Monday. The UCI have turned down that request. No other teams seem to have got behind that at this stage. And I think, there's a COVID on the one hand, and, we wait for the second round of tests on the next rest day, but the weather is also a major concern, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, it's the fact that the last few days, or today in particular, was so cold. We heard just how awful and miserable of a day James had. You do have to wonder at what sort of level these riders' immune system is at, and how susceptible they are to catching COVID. And then on top of that, what if you caught COVID alongside another cold and chest infection? I think it was here that you had mentioned that at the end of the Tour de France, a lot of riders seemed to come out of it actually healthier than normal, just due to the fact that the protocols that were put in place. And, the minute riders start, playing that game of fire with their immune system, they can become incredibly susceptible to all sorts. And to be honest, when you're that cold and you're kind of put in this state of just survival, you have to think, are you as worried about COVID at the finish line? Are you worried about getting a mask when you're shivering? You're probably more worried about, getting a jacket and, what sort of kind of protocols are going out the window just to keep riders warm and, not hypothermic.
I mean, let's be honest. I think there's absolutely no chance they're going to go over the Stelvio. I mean, it's 2,700 meters, and it's pushing towards the end of October. It's just not going to be possible, is it? Because
let's imagine then that we do lose, the major climbs and the altitude in particular. That makes João Almeida an even more credible contender for this race, whenever and however it ends. He's not looked in any trouble at any point. Nobody's tried to put him in trouble at any point, which has been perhaps surprising. Perhaps it hasn't been the terrain for that yet. But he's looked incredibly assured and comfortable, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely youth on his side. And, you know, even 2 days ago when Sagan won, that the fact that he still sprinted and took third place out of a pretty select group of riders shows that he's on incredible form. And, you know, if we do get to the high mountains, you know, those small efforts could kind of come back and bite him in the heels. But if we don't go over those passes, you know, he potentially could be in the running for overall victory.
Yeah, I mean, this weekend is going to be the first big indicator, isn't it? There's the time trial on Saturday. I was looking at, well, he's only been a professional since the start of the season, so there's not a lot of top-level time trialing results to base much on. And, of course, the most recent is the opening time trial here in the Giro, which was around about half the length of the one that is coming up on Saturday. Of course, it was quite a downhill effort, wasn't it, on that opening day. So we'll see how he does in the time trial. And then there's the uphill finish to Piancavallo on Saturday, 1,288 metres, I think that is. So, you know, that's a decent enough test. And, I mean, looking forward to the final week and what will and won't be possible, Ian. I mean, I was just thinking about the descending when it's sort of 5 degrees. What's that like? I mean, we could be talking about the temperatures being close to freezing, and I mean, it's more the descents, I think, than the actual climbs that's the problem. If the roads are open, that's one thing, but coming down the other side of a climb like the Stelvio when it's absolutely freezing cold, that's the bit that will concern everyone more, I think.
Yeah, and especially on a climb that long, you're gonna inevitably, you know, get hot, and you can't ride up the climb with a rain jacket zipped up and all the proper clothing that you would need on the descents. Then it becomes a case of, you know, how quickly can you get that clothing on? And, you know, you could hear from James today just how cold he was. It becomes incredibly difficult to even zip up a jacket. And when you get to the finish line, like he said, you know, he could hardly see, you know, you're very close. I mean, it always amazes me how far professional athletes push themselves. And the fact that, you know, James could get to that point of, you know, just physical distress and still, you know, ride to the finish is incredible. And, you know, descending something like the Stelvio when you're that cold is incredibly dangerous. And it's probably something that, you know, we've seen the CPA try to put in a cold weather protocol, but, you know, this race and the RCS wants this race to go to Milan. And I think they're going to try to do everything possible to make that happen and make the show, you know, a spectacle.
What do you make, Richard, of Jonathan Vaughter's calling for the race to be curtailed on Sunday evening, really? Just go through the time trial and an uphill finish and call it quits and say that the 2020 Giro was a fortnight.
I mean, a cynic might say that they have they've got two stage wins in the race and that they've done pretty well out of the race and would have less to lose from the race stopping on Sunday than other teams. It's a strange one. I mean, there's nothing to stop them pulling out. There is, of course, there are rules in place to stop, or there are penalties for teams pulling out. But in these circumstances, you know, they've one rider of theirs, Lawson Craddock, left the race to return to his pregnant partner, which everybody understands. And I think everybody, it certainly wouldn't look good if the UCI, you know, issued fines or some other penalty to a team that withdrew in these circumstances at this time. So there's nothing to stop them leaving the race. So it's a curious one in a way to unilaterally call for the race to be stopped.
Would the fines be greater than the fines for wearing jerseys with ducks?
Well, exactly. They were fined like €4,000 or 4,000 Swiss francs, weren't they, for their kit at this race? I mean, I think we have to wait and see what the COVID tests come up with on Monday. That's the key date now, and that will, you know, we saw with Mitchell and Scott, they had one case with Simon Yates, and a few days later it was another four cases. So, you know, it's confused a bit because the team that had a rider test positive for COVID, Jumbo Visma, did pull out. The other team that had a rider test positive for COVID, Michael Matthews of Sunweb, well, his second test came back negative. So, you know, it might not be that the Sunweb riders have been exposed to it directly within their own team. Jumbo Visma, as far as we know, the Kreuzwick test was valid, and So, you know, they've pulled out. Mitch and Scott are away as well. So it's feasible, I suppose, that all the riders are okay on Monday. But who knows? But that's going to be absolutely critical in determining whether the race makes it to Milan or not, I think. Shall we wrap things up there, chaps?
Let's do it.
Ian, you're going to be joining us again, I think, for the next few nights.
I will be.
And let's hope that Daniel Freib can resolve his computer issues for tomorrow evening. We do want him to join us before he heads off.
I was going to say, I know he mentioned that he was having technical issues, but his pick for the Giro, Pernsteiner, lost some places today. So maybe he was a little bit embarrassed to come on the show.
Yeah, that did cross my mind. Yeah, he's his rider, isn't he? And he did lose a bit of time today. So you're probably right, Ian. He's probably made it up. We did see him on screen briefly, didn't we? And he had a rather fetching kind of skull cap on, which I'm not sure he'd been running.
He'd just been running. Before we just go, because today's stage did start and finish in Cesenatico, I mean, if Daniel had been on, we would have probably talked a bit about Marco Pantani. But I mean, if you want to listen to what we said about Cesenatico and Pantani, you can go back and listen to our Giro. There was a fair bit in that. But also, stage 10 of last year's Giro coverage, 2019, features the trip that Daniel and I made to the Marco Pantani Museum in the town, and we also had a Piadina sandwich at the family-owned sandwich shop. So it was quite a nice little package that Daniel put together on that. So stage 10 of last year's Giro coverage, if you want to have a listen to that.
So you've had a sandwich by Mrs. Pantani, but no chocolate mousse by Mrs. Merckx. Never mind. I'm trying to think of any food that I've had made by famous cyclists. I'll have to get back to you on that. We released our third episode of the week, I think, today, of Kilometer Zero, powered by Zwift. That is the latest installment of our Rider Diaries. There'll be more episodes of Kilometer Zero next week. You're off to do a Zwift ride now, Lionel, I think, a cappuccino ride.
I am the evening cappuccino ride, yes, with however many people have registered to join the Zwift meetup. We'll be doing a lap or two of Central Park in New York. I mean, I better get a move on. We're starting in 45 minutes. I've got to get over to New York.
When's the next one? Sunday morning?
Sunday morning, yes. And if you check out our Twitter feed, I must work out a way to put this on our website so that people can easily apply to join the meetup rides. But there'll be one on Sunday morning, 9:30 UK time. If you'd like a place, email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and just call your email Zwift Ride, and I'll until it's full, I'll keep adding people.
Great. Well, thank you, Ian, and thank you, Lionel. And before we go, a few thank yous from us to friends of the podcast. Those of you who've signed up at thecyclingpodcast.com. From me, a big thank you to James Maltby, Nicholas Skip, Chad Marshall, Christopher Howlett, Matthew Grant, and Edgar McCulloch.
And from me, Stuart Toombs, Gareth Wells, Alan Howe, Martin Douglas, Graham Loaf, and Daniel Power.
And a big thank you from me to Stuart Ross, to Paul Bowles Belzenegui, Mary Garner, Brad Duff, Callum Duncan, JJ Steen, and Andrew Derrick.